From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. No one is quite ready to stand down in North Dakota, even though the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it'll look for an alternative route for the Dakota Access Pipeline, currently set to run through territory the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe claims by treaty. Is the federal government's shift a win for pipeline protesters, or just the latest volley in a fight that's nowhere near over? And in our second half hour, a new museum has opened at UC Davis. The home of the Aggies is better known for agriculture and medicine, but there's art happening there too, and the museum gives Davis a platform to shout out loud about it. That's coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. The federal government on Sunday denied a permit that would have allowed completion of the last 1,100 feet of a 1,200-mile oil pipeline stretching across the Midwest. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says the stretch in question could contaminate their water supply and disturb sacred sites. Pipeline supporters are waiting for a new presidential administration to reverse course and let construction continue. We've got two reporters with us online familiar with this story. Linda Mapes, environment reporter with the Seattle Times. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And James McPherson, reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Linda, I'll just throw out the first question to you, but James, feel free to jump in here. I mean, it's freezing out there, is it not? Is this just an idea, you know, is this kind of last minute change in position, a ploy to get people off the ice?
No, you know, it's important for people to recognize they actually won. I mean, it's a very big deal. This is not ephemeral. It's not a hoax. It's the real thing, and people can and should trust it. I mean, the Army Corps has withheld the final easement that's needed to do what needs to be done to finish the pipeline, and there is no contractor that is going to risk their people and equipment on some, like, rogue pirate middle-of-the-night operation breaking the law to just go ahead anyway. And furthermore, it's not a small matter. We're talking about a mile-long crossing underneath the river, lots of people and equipment, big lay down and open space on the prairie. I mean, you can't hide a walnut shell out there, and you're not going to get any contractor willing to do it. I mean, this is Michael's construction company out of Brownsville, Wisconsin, one of the biggest horizontal directional drilling companies in the nation, and they're not going to go out there at the behest of Energy Transfer and punch under the Missouri River. I mean, this thing is over for now, and it's going to be in the courts, and it's going to be with us all for many, many, many months to come, and that doesn't change just because Donald Trump takes office in a couple of weeks. I mean, you can't just say, oh, well, I guess we don't need an EIS. Forget it. Get cracking. I mean, it isn't like that. You can't just tweet your way out of this. It'll go to court and get fought over if they decide that suddenly an EIS doesn't matter.
James McPherson, do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, by and large. You asked about the weather. This is brutal, even by North Dakota standards today. We have a blizzard. Roads, highways are closed. Schools are closed. Minus 20 wind chill, I believe. So that's playing into this at this point.
Energy Transfer Partners and Sunoco Logistics, the companies behind the project, have called this ruling a, quote, purely political action, essentially accusing the Obama administration of abandoning the rule of law, as they put it, in favor of currying favor with a narrow and extreme political constituency. Again, that's in quotes, and said the pipeline project would go ahead. Is that wishful thinking?
I think it is wishful thinking. It's just not that simple. I mean, first of all, politics are legal, last I checked. And secondly, you know, you look at the process under which this thing was permitted, and it is legal to do it the way it was done. But I think it's fair to say that three other federal agencies also took issue with the short shrift review that this pipeline project received. I mean, it was done under a piecemeal fast-track process in which only individual water crossings were looked at and never looked at as a pipeline with its full environmental impact statement review. I mean, that never happened, and the tribe has been saying for years that it deserved a full environmental review, and now it's finally going to get one. I mean, it's also come to light in the Corps' memo. They referenced important documents that were withheld from the tribe during the fast-track piecemeal review, including a look at potential oil spill impacts in the Missouri River. I mean, there are a lot of overlooked information in this process. The company itself, its own contractors, were the ones that did most of the review for the environmental assessment. You know, it wasn't an illegal process, but neither was it sufficient. That's what the tribe's been saying all along, and they're going to push hard for this thing to finally get the close, hard look that environmental impact statement requires.
I would agree with that. This is James, but I don't think we can forget that the president-elect supports construction of the pipeline.
And that
it's
is
not
a,
clear
yeah.
whether he's going to reverse the Army's decision. He also has held or may still hold stock in the company.
That's a good point that you make. What are the legal ramifications? I mean, is this the sort of thing that with an executive order he can wave away?
I think that's unclear.
Go ahead, Jane.
No,
I mean, you can't do that. If he tries to do that, it'll instantly go to court. I mean, that's what lawyers and courtrooms are for. I mean, you have an agency that's made an administrative finding, and you can't just now say, poof, that doesn't matter. I mean, it also, by the way, is classically the kind of thing that courts take a very hard look at when you have a change of administration to do exactly the sort of review that would then be undertaken to say, okay, Corps of Engineers, you think we need an EIS. Why do you think that? Let's take a good look at this record. And I think when they take that look, they're going to find all sorts of missed issues and important issues.
James, do you want to jump in there?
I think there certainly will be litigation if the president-elect overturns this, certainly, and that's going to make its way through the courts. And at the same time, the company in court filings has said it's losing at $2.7 million a day on this project. And I think that pencils out to about 900 and some dollars this year in lost revenue and so on.
So it's no small matter, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I just want to throw out the phone number for listeners to call in, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. We're on Twitter and Facebook. Chris comments, unfortunately, it looks like a temporary victory. Fred comments, took long enough. And when Trump takes to power, who will step in to protect the water protectors? We've covered some of this ground. You know, let me ask both of you, right? Early in this process, the companies were considering routing the pipeline near Bismarck in North Dakota. Why couldn't we just divert the pipeline? What would be involved with that?
Well, there's no reason why you couldn't. I mean, what the Army Corps has called for is exactly that, an analysis of alternative routes. This is exactly the work that was never done and would be done now. Take a look at, well, gee, maybe Bismarck was the better choice, or who knows, maybe they'll decide this is the best choice. But that's exactly what lies ahead, is an assessment, an analysis of alternative routes.
James?
Yeah, the Army Corps did look at this, but not hard. It was one route earlier that they looked at, and there were problems going through urban areas. Cost was another, and certainly the potential for Bismarck, Mandan, sister cities, water supply. So if they'll look at that again, I think that's unknown, but certainly there's pipe to there pretty much at this point.
Linda, you know, it's interesting what James is talking about there, right? Like urban areas, so public protest, one presumes that that was a reason they might have steered clear there. Concerns about the water supply, a reason they might have steered clear there.
How ironic, right?
And yes, it turns out that some of the same concerns were evidenced
exactly.
Here, yes.
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the things that was bitterly held by the Sioux tribe. I mean, they make the point, I think, very well. Oh, great. So they don't want it near the municipal wellheads of Bismarck. Let's bring it down to Indian country, a half mile from our border, 10 miles from our drinking water intake. I don't think so. That you know, that sat very hard with people, and I think it's part of the reason this blew up to an international story. I mean, there were very fundamental issues of justice here that people just did not have a hard time grasping.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got David in San Francisco.
Yeah, morning. Two different things, and they're tied to the fast-track permits. I'm from St. Louis, and I remember when they tried to put in a highway, just 5 miles of highway took probably 10 or 15 years worth of permits to do. This pipeline is almost 1,800 miles long, and as I understand right, they did it in 6 months. So when you think this thing is going to cross 200 different waterways, it's going to cross the Missouri River at where the protest site is, but it's also crossing the Mississippi River near some nuclear power plants. So you imagine if this thing busted open near the cooling intake of a nuclear power plant. So I'm wondering how the architectural standards of this were put together for 200 waterway crossings in 6 months. This is preposterous, and I'm wondering if it also ties to what's called the Kelo decision, which had to do with eminent domain for private purposes.
James, do you want to answer that one?
Well, the pipeline is 1,172 miles long. Most of it's here in North Dakota, the bulk of it. It was a two-year review process. It went through all four states, the Dakotas, Iowa, Illinois. Interesting, however, was that the company began last year stockpiling pipe well ahead of obtaining permits and easements on this in all four states.
I guess let's keep moving. That's a great question, David, and I thank you. Let's keep moving just to get to the next question, which I think is kind of related there. Tom in Los Gatos.
Yeah, hi, Rachel. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying your program. I think the most exciting thing that happened recently and really energized my spirit was the thousands of veterans who had decided to converge on the project and to act as a human shield. And they're actually the counter juntas, I think, because our last election was heavily influenced by the military. You know, Donald Trump bragged about 240 generals and admirals who supported him. And then in his thank you tour last week, he, you know, congratulated the active and off-duty or retired military personnel in Cincinnati. So he's done these twice. He's bragged about it, military involvement. And these veterans are vital not only for the project, but for the nation as a whole. They should, energize and activate and be counter activists throughout our country. Including California, which, needs a lot of protection, too.
Thank you, Tom. Anyway, yeah.
Thank you.
Linda, do I hear you wanting to chime in there?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no question that the fact that 2,000 veterans were about to converge in the camp from all over the country to act as human shields against police who were going after these protesters with rubber bullets, tear gas, pepper spray, freezing water. I mean, I think that was an absolute outrage to people around the world. It's the reason the veterans mustered, if you will, to come. And, you know, people were becoming very concerned that there was a real showdown brewing that could even result in people getting killed. And I can't imagine that wasn't part of the calculus. You know, when the Army Corps of Engineers issues this decision on a Sunday afternoon by one of the political appointees, I mean, you just have to know that part of what they're thinking about is the busloads of veterans about to converge on the camp. I mean, I don't know how many people are on the ground there. I've heard so many different estimates, but it was recently, as this morning, I've heard 10,000 people. Hard to imagine in the temperatures you're describing there. But, you know, this thing has absolutely blown up to the sort of proportion that it was just unsustainable politically. And the veterans, I think, helped push it over the top. But let's remember, this has been going on since last August and only gotten bigger, bigger, and bigger.
Interesting. Go ahead, James.
I would agree. The numbers are really hard to pin down. I've been going out there for months now. In fact, drove back yesterday evening in a snowstorm. I will say Sunday when the veterans came there, I counted at the muster about 200. There were others in camp. They did say that the elders had asked them to basically stand down and not confront law enforcement, and I believe they honored that. But I will say Sunday when this decision came down, it was the most people I've seen there in the months of covering this. And, for example, it took the camp is about a half square mile, the big encampment. It took me 2 hours to get out because of all the traffic.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's
so you could see why people would be impressed with the number of folks who were gathering there despite the weather.
It's grown, but I guess time will tell with blizzards and, you know, these really life-threatening wind chills. Will people indeed stay? Now, you know, the Standing Rock chairman, Dave Archibald, has told people basically to go home. Worried about the weather and that this probably won't, there won't be any big developments for months. And I would say this isn't a checkmate. It's more of a check. There's a lot of unknowns still in this, and not the least of which is President-elect Donald Trump.
Let's go to the phones again, and Marcia in Palo Alto.
Yeah, I just wondered, Energy Transfer Partners continually to say that they will build it anyway, and so I wondered what the panelists thought about that, because it is something that worries me, that they will build
just
it
just
anyway,
roll ahead and mm-hmm. ask for forgiveness later. Linda, is that a concern?
It's just not going to happen. I mean, there is not a contractor that is willing to take that kind of risk in this high profile setting. It is just not realistic. It's not worth it to them. It's not legal. They'd never get another job again from the federal government, and contractors of this size live off those big federal contracts in addition to big private jobs. It's not going to happen. People ought to go home, get warm, be with their families, stand down. This thing is now in the courts, and that's where it's going to be for many, many months. There's just not going to be some pirate action drilling under the river in the middle of the night. It's
but
not
could,
going to happen.
But could that calculus talked, change? Oh, go ahead, Dad.
The people
Jackson.
I've talked to out there, however, don't believe that. And
no.
don't
I know they don't
that
believe
at all.
It, but I think it's
and,
true, right?
And in fact are bowing to stay despite this. And despite the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe asking them to leave.
I do want to ask this question, though. Like, all right, so in a few weeks, we're going to have a new administration. The president-elect has hinted that he's more than hinted that he's in support of the project, may even be invested in some of the companies that could benefit from the project. Might the pipeline constructors not think, you know, this is going to swing our way in the long run. We're just going to hurry it along.
I just don't think any contractor is going to take that risk. There's just no way. I mean, no, it's not going to happen. And the people in the camps, they're heavily invested emotionally for a lot of people. This is some of the, you know, they believe in this deeply. How else could it be that they could stand there in these incredible weather conditions? But, you know, I think the chairman is right. This thing is done, and it's done in large measure because of the heart and the work they brought to it. But for now, nothing's going to happen, and they ought to go home. It's, you know, their work is done. They've done what they needed to do, and they should stay vigilant. The thing is, however, not just easily brushed aside because administration changes. The law just doesn't work that way.
Let's go now to Ron in San Francisco.
Hi. This is a great curiosity to me on liability. I've been working for years with hopeandbeyond.org, and we focused on Flint, Michigan, and the corrosive waters that were pumped through the citizens' pipes, which corroded to the point of distributing lead. I'm trying to get to a point.
Okay.
What effect, if we have a leak, and that distributes to water of the citizens in the area, who carries the liability of the bioaccumulative toxics that will affect these people 10, 20, or 30 years from now? Who pays for that? Does the energy company pay for that, or is that the taxpayer?
Linda, James, who wants to take that on?
Well, I mean, I guess we've all seen that inevitably it winds up being the taxpayer, right? I mean, that's what Superfund is for. That's what all these programs are for, and that's why we have environmental review to try to keep this kind of thing from happening, and that's why a full EIS and a careful review of a oil pipeline traveling four states is needed. I mean, I think what this thing has really brought to light is the broken regulatory process here. I mean, it's just nuts that it can take, you know, years to build a segment of highway over, you know, flat ground without any water crossing, but you can build an oil pipeline across four states without any federal regulatory oversight whatsoever, other than a fragmented review every time it touches water, but never a consideration of the project as an actual oil pipeline. I mean, that's nuts. That's crazy, and it's one of the reasons we find ourselves where we are.
Ron, thank you for that question. A related tweet from Jeffrey, the EIR that the Dakota Access Pipeline needs must include the impact of the oil it will carry. To do otherwise is like calculating the alcohol content of beer by only looking at the alcohol content of the can it comes in. Here's a question from Robert. What bank loans and other funding are involved, and how are those lenders addressing the new risks of this project, including environmental concerns and low oil prices? James, you want to tackle that one?
There's a whole slew of banks that are involved in financing this project, Wells Fargo among them. I don't know how that's affecting within their business, what they're thinking. But certainly it's on their radar. There have been protests at some of these banks for the past month or so.
That's a really interesting aspect of this. I mean, this has now come into the consumer realm. We're seeing protests all over Seattle at Wells Fargo Bank and some of the other big banks that are financing this thing. I mean, what we have to recognize is this has become not just a question about one pipeline. It has become a movement, a fossil fuel movement. And consumers are starting to take this into their own hands by attacking the banks that are, you know, underwriting these projects, attacking the gas stations associated with the oil companies that are building them. I mean, it's becoming a much larger, more diffuse, more enduring movement fueled by social media and the ease of people to now get together and stick together in these causes. And I can tell you out here in the Northwest, where the government in Canada has just approved an even bigger pipeline moving tar sands oil into the heart of Cascadia in Vancouver, B.C. I got a picture of what that's going to look like if Kinder Morgan thinks they're going to be able to build that pipeline. They're already mobilizing mass civil disobedience.
Well, with that, I want to thank both of our guests, Linda Mapes and James McPherson, for joining us in this conversation about the Dakota Access Pipeline. Coming up, we're going to talk about UC Davis's brand spanking new Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem Museum of Art, and we'll be talking with the museum's director about that. Stay with us. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.